Episode 139 for November 24th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hassenflow from the past.
And I'm Pam Bedour from the future.
I'm the ghost of Christmas present. This is fine. Yes, here we are. The three parts of time travel all come together, past, present, and future, to end the novel, boy, I tell you, my favorite novel of all time, The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger.
This was such a fun book to reread. I had read this when this came out, and it was definitely time for me to take another read. And I just enjoyed the interview with Audrey so much last week. Thank you, Steve, for bringing this to us.
Chip, how do you feel about this book?
I'm a first-time reader. It was a nice book to read. It was a nice story. Certainly, there's a lot going on to it, and she is a very skilled person putting together a time travel novel and having all the areas connect. I can only imagine how challenging that would be to write and make sure all the past and the future and the present situations line up together.
And there's so many working, moving parts to this that on a second read, Pam, you've seen so much more than on the first, right?
Oh, definitely. And I found it very interesting as we were reading this fourth part, as we got to the end of the novel this week, I had forgotten about Henry's frostbite and losing his feet. And isn't that strange that, like, what I took away from the book, which I mean, I remembered their relationship beautifully. I remembered the daughter, the miscarriages, the friends, but I had somehow repressed, I guess, really, really horrifying detail that once he gets that injury, he knows he's going to die. There's really no way that he can survive his time traveling genetic abnormality without the ability to run. And I remembered the shooting, but I had forgotten that really horrific segment, which was just such an embodiment of the metaphor of fatalism that goes through this novel, where, you know, Henry always likes to think that he only knows the past and the future's still open, but it isn't, you know. And I think that in the end, there's something in this novel that does suggest something I don't believe in the slightest, but that a lot of people do, that predetermination is a possibility. And so it's, and you know, for a book whose perspective on not only life and relationships and friendship, but also time is so different from my own belief system, I really enjoyed it.
It's interesting that you draw a line between fatalism and predestination, that there is, you know, fatalism is, yes, we are destined to die. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There will be a moment that is destiny, that fatalism. And at the same time, we have free will. We can make choices along the way to get to that final moment.
But don't you think that in this novel, because Henry time travels, and so he can see what's going to come and what has come before in a way that you and I don't have that genetic abnormality, so we can't do it, she's really suggesting that free will is just an illusion.
Yes. She is definitely putting that out there and crafting a story around that idea in such a skilled way that, yeah, on second reading, you forgot one of the main things, the frostbite takes his feet.
Yeah.
And I remembered that, and I saw the foreshadowing of that from the first chapter, where he has a book on his shelf about frostbite injuries, because that's something that he's concerned about, because he understands how that could happen.
It talks a little bit of the danger of the time traveling. Throughout the book, it's not that we forget it, but it's just not, everything's relatively successful. you know, he goes back, he sees, you know, Claire, he goes back, and this ends up happening. He's learned to survive, but, you know, at some point, you arrive naked in a sub-freezing time, and you lose your feet, mm-hmm. Ultimately. And I do think that there is, you know, the voice of fate comes through, and whether, you know, everything is predetermined. And, you know, I was trying to think of why it was important to lose his feet. And my solution before the discussion started was, it was just to show that time travel was dangerous. He gets back in, what is it, September, and the nurses are like, why does he have frostbite?
Mm-hmm. I think that also Audrey was working on that theme of wings and flight and birds from the beginning of this book. And the idea that Claire was working on this art where she's making these wings to give to Henry. This imagery of angel, this imagery of flight, this imagery of getting away is so well put in every aspect of this book.
Well, and also, I think the wings represent an alternate form of transportation, right? As does the time travel. So we have our ways of moving through the world, right? On our feet, in our cars, in our airplanes. And so those wings present a different alternative. But we also have a way of moving through time from the past, through the present, into the future. And so really, Henry represents both of those things. And the loss of his feet represent becoming unanchored from time, unanchored from the ways that we usually move in the world.
Wow. Because he can't drive. He won't go in an airplane because he is sure that he will time travel out of the airplane. He's not sure that he would be able to re-find his way back to that airplane. So, wow, transportation as a theme. I had not done... Wow. Wow.
Well, time and space, right?
But also gravity, as freeing as going through time could be, he is limited to where he can go because he can't go by airplane. I mean, but he said he couldn't do it. He can't drive a car. Well, so his circle of where in his reality where he can go is confined, but the time element is, you know, I mean, was it 50 years forward, 50 years back? Incredible.
Yeah, I love this book.
So guys, let's go back to last week and the interview with Audrey, which was so much fun. What was your one or two main great takeaways from that interview that you just want to remind people of as we go into this final segment?
Writing is a process. It takes a long time for her. She contemplates it very deeply. And even for a person who is skilled at putting together, say, a book, it really is work for her. It's a labor of love, but it is work. And she marvels at people who can just kind of sit down and bang out stories just like most of us.
That care that she puts into her work, that I as a reader can absolutely see the path that she was writing from the beginning, with all the themes and all of the foreshadowing and the pieces that fall into place almost magically, but I can see where she really put that care into this work. Probably just the same way that she does with all of her physical artwork, where she is designing and thinking and redesigning and rethinking until she gets it right. And I think she got it right with this book. I have high expectations for her sequel, and I really hope that we get to see that sometime soon.
And that was my big takeaway from the interview, was this notion of a sequel, which I hadn't anticipated. And so I was really excited about that. And I was intrigued when she said that her sequel would have eco-critical themes, mm-hmm. because that is a really timely thing to be working on. And, you know, I've just noticed in my own, you know, limited research on eco-criticism and feminist eco-criticism specifically, the ways that gender, environmentalism, and temporality are really being questioned right now and are really being explored. So I just love to see that she's doing that work. I'm very, very excited.
With a female protagonist, no less. Uh-huh.
Exactly.
I'm very intrigued, and I would love for her to take a little less care and give us a copy.
No. We want it to be great. So we will, as soon as that book comes out, we'll do it for the show.
No doubt.
Now, and I also really liked that she talked about how temperamentally she's more like Henry, but job-wise, she's more like Claire. And I thought that was really neat. And it really made me think about how Claire's and Henry's jobs are really, really important in this. The fact that Claire is an artist, the fact that Henry is a librarian. I mean, we had talked about this a little bit, but talking with her sort of opened that up for me a little bit more.
And that idea of how important art is to any plain, regular situation. The people who criticize art as being frivolous in any way and are the ones who are tuning into their Netflix and Hulu accounts in this pandemic because entertainment is so vital to their well-being, their mental health. It's like, yeah, that's critical. Those artistic expressions of humanity are on display in this book.
And of course, I was really thinking about it epistemologically too, the different ways we have of knowing things. You guys know me. And it struck me that Henry, who's a librarian, is focused on data, on information, on how we collect, curate, and preserve information. And that's really all about how we think about truth and perspective across time. So his job as a librarian, I mean, librarians are time travelers in a sense, just like historians, just like maybe literature professors or readers who read deeply and with a lot of care. These are the perspectives that we get into the past, but also into imagining the future. And then Clara, as an artist, has sort of a similar perspective on temporality in that art is the thing that survives. Now, I've just been rereading Margaret Atwood's Mad Adam trilogy, the first book of which is Oryx and Crake, which we're going to read in this book club, I'm excited to say. And there's this great moment in Oryx and Crake where you've got the scientist and the artist talking, and the scientist is like, who cares about art? Like, we have to save humanity. Here's how we do it. And the artist says, yeah, but after humanity is done, what do you think will survive? It's art. And that idea that art survives, whether it's our individual human lives or our collective species life, that's pretty deep. And I think that's one of the themes of temporality that this novel really touches upon.
And you've also put Station 11 on our list, which is same theme
yes.
of art in the loss of humanity. Where do we find humanity? It's in the arts.
Art in the apocalypse, something I've been thinking about lately. I don't know why.
I don't know.
Are they really that different, though?
So, for me, I think the theme of loss is the main theme that I get from this book. And we talked to Audrey last week, and I think that she really feels that the idea of relationships was her main idea for this story. And we see both of those on display very much in this fourth portion here. We see Henry trying to give Claire what he thinks of as a normal life, and boy, does he succeeds really well with giving her what she needs here.
What do you mean by that? Are you talking about the winning the lottery? Is that what you're saying? What she needs, the resources?
The resources in the money to win the lottery, which she was certainly against that idea of using this time travel to win the lottery. That's cheating. And he says, okay, just burn the ticket. No problem. And she's like, no, we need these resources. And then the whole house hunting, that whole wonderful scene where they're trying to find the perfect house and he's trying to give her the experience, the quote unquote normal experience of shopping for a house, despite the fact that he knows what the right house is because he's seen it.
So frustrating. So annoying. Like how he, when they go into a house, he just walks into the backyard and then
says, nope, this is not it. And the poor real estate lady is like, wait, what, how do you know this is not it? He, nope, this is not it.
I'm going to descend a little bit on this analysis of it, because Henry has a totally different relationship with his daughter. They get thrown through time. They wind up at places. I mean, they're naked. They don't have anything. So, you know, there's one of the final chapters talks about she had like some ill-fitting dress and he had like whatever he found. They don't have anything. They only have the time they spend together to kind of work with each other and to create the relationship they have. So it's for them, it's a little different than what she's experiencing, what he's experiencing with Claire, who he has more of a contemporary experience with, because he eventually they marry and have, you know, while he's time traveling to or in different eras, you know, he also has this grounded life with her that is, you know, what I guess would you call the present.
Mm-hmm. And so well done. Yes, the relationship between Alba and Henry is very different from quote unquote normal, but it's so wonderful that they get to share those moments together and they spend them as well as they can. And those moments where Henry appears in Alba's life and she is absolutely throwing away anything else that's happening. The scene in the museum where she's on a field trip and her father shows up and the teacher's like, no, her father's dead. Who are you, stranger? And she's like, no, call my mother. My mother will explain to you that this is my father. He's a time traveler. It's fine. I love it. I love every moment of it.
And I have to say, this book feels so complete. And so it's just such a little surprise and a treat to think that we're going to get a sequel and spend more time with Henry and Alba, because it does feel, you know, there's a very complete feeling. This isn't a novel where you're like, you end it and you're like, oh, I can't wait for the sequel. But the fact of a sequel, and it kind of reminds me of Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. She calls the books 2 and 3, she calls them siblings rather than sequels. I'm going to be kind of curious if this has that feel to it as well. Like this second novel in the same world with the same characters, I bet will be very easy to read alone as well, in that these relationships that she'll be exploring, especially with an eco-critical bent, you know, will be very complete onto themselves.
The next generation. Very interesting.
And as she's exploring those relationships and the romance between Claire and Henry, there's also such a focus, obviously, on loneliness and longing. And I really like that we see so many moments of Claire just waiting for Henry, being worried and whatever. But then near the end, there's this very short chapter that's in Claire's voice that begins, "This is a secret. Sometimes I am glad when Henry is gone. Sometimes I enjoy being alone." And I'm like, oh, are we not supposed to say that? That's a totally normal married person thing. You know, is this really a secret? But or is it just the reality that even if you're in a wonderful, wonderful marriage, mm-hmm. that you still sometimes do need that time alone and you do need to still feel like you're a complete person, even outside of the relationship that you have with this most important person in your life. And I think she really captures both that need for your partner, but also that need to hold on to yourself and who you are.
And it's so well.
That reminds me of Melinda Carlisle, the lead singer of the Go-Go's, response to The Secret to a Happy Marriage. And she said, separate bedrooms.
Yeah.
So that ability to sort of have your private space and to have your privacy allows you to be the fulfill your needs as a human, but also be prepared for your time with your spouse.
and to honor that time for that other person as well. I think that that is critical to a wonderful relationship. My wife and I have a fantastic relationship, but no, we're not always doing the same things. She does not go to all the sci-fi conventions that I go to because she's not interested in that. But that's wonderful. That balance is so critical, especially in the pandemic when we're all in the same house together all the time. We need our space, we need our time, and we need to honor that for our spouses for sure.
And I think this really relates to the way that she explores the other relationships that Henry has in his life. And she doesn't give him too many friends, right? Like, I think it's kind of funny. The economy of relationships is pretty funny. Like, oh, it so happens that Henry's best friend is married to Clara's best friend. So how convenient is that? There's no extra characters in all of this. But with Dr. Kendrick, who is Henry's, you know, science friend, the guy who actually confirms that he does have a genetic disorder, that this sort of, you know, could be seen as a little bit floofy explanation for time travel is accurate. It's interesting that Kendrick and Henry are very, very close in a lot of ways. And I mean, Kendrick knows Alba in a way that no one else can or does, but they're also very separate. And there's this great scene early on after Henry proves that he's a time traveler by telling Kendrick the very sad news that his son is going to have a genetic disorder. They meet and they have a very deep scene. Then afterwards they shake hands and Henry says, "We are strangers again after the intimacies of the afternoon." And then I walk out of his office downstairs into the street where the sun has been waiting for me. Whatever I am, what am I? What am I? Hmm. And there's this notion that, like, Kendrick can start to answer that question of what he is, you know, he has a genetic disorder. It's like chrono disorder, whatever, but he also can't, you know, we just have these ways that we interact with people that have limits around them.
And that hand wavium of this time travel, that it is genetic. There is I think that Audrey puts together a very good scientific explanation for the time travel disorder. Now, Chip, before our interview with Audrey, you said that you weren't quite clear on how chromosomes could be a part of this. Were you okay with her explanation in this portion?
No.
You're still too hand wavy.
Well, the deal. When writing a story, you have to have a point where you have to suspend disbelief and you just go with it. And that's what I have to do. I mean, this is she had to come up with a reason for doing it. She explained the reason why she did it, what was in the news, and she needed to have a strategy that was out of his control, that it was not something that he could control, because he would be a jerk. But what do we know? But what do we know about his daughter, Alba? She can control it
to a degree.
There we go. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Dr. Kendrick, for teaching her when she's young.
Right.
Well, how about going against Claire's wishes and mm-hmm. And pricking the arm and confirming that she had the genetic disorder mm-hmm. when Claire was like, I don't want my child knowing that yet. I want her to make a decision at 18. But Henry defies her.
That's so funny, though, because that's so arbitrary. And Claire is so annoyed that Henry makes her wait to be 18 to have sex. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just so funny that she tries to do that to someone else, to limit another person's freedom, when she found it so frustrating for herself. And I'm going to tell you, I thought Henry was right on this. If you have a genetic disorder, you get to make the decisions about your child with a genetic disorder because you understand the experience.
Boy, there's some deep questions there, Pam.
You got two different parents. Which parent supersedes?
Oh, boy.
The time traveler.
Wow.
I'm with Audrey on this.
I think of all of my deaf and hard of hearing students and how that could be seen as a genetic disorder and how they would not trade genetic disorder for quote unquote normality because that's just who they are.
But don't you think that their parents who are also deaf and hard of hearing are much better positioned to make those kinds of, to help them make those kinds of.
Boy.
I don't know. We won't solve that here.
They're actually,
I mean, in the news this week, I think it was in Norway. Anyway, one of the Scandinavian countries, I think, they're actually eradicating a certain type of challenge. And the question is it moral to do it that way? So anyway, you can always go to the news and pose your philosophical questions.
That is going to be the philosophical question of the genetic manipulation that we can do now, the science that we can do with CRISPR and other devices. And we're not going to get into that in this book. Maybe in the next book.
Now, so, and there's a real exploration of parenthood throughout this novel. And one of the things that really stood out to me on a second reading that I think I hadn't paid enough attention to the first time was Claire's relationship with her own mother. And so, which comes out of her relationship with her own daughter and trying to control who her daughter is and who she's allowed to be from a young age by preventing her from seeking medical confirmation of her disorder. If we want to call it a disorder, and I'm not committed to calling it a disorder, but from her travel ability.
Her mutation.
Exactly. But I thought it was really, I actually really loved this time around pausing when Claire's mother dies and Claire finds the poetry that her mother was always writing poetry. And I don't think that Claire especially paid too much attention, as one doesn't pay too much attention to what one's parents produce. And Claire started reading this poem, and there's this really beautiful little poem written from the year that her mother had lost a baby and tried to kill herself. And this is Claire reading it after her history with miscarriages. And she finds a poem addressed to herself, "The Garden Under Snow." I'll just read the beginning for Claire. "Now the garden is under snow, a blank page our footprints write on. Claire, who was never mine, but always belonged to herself." And I was like, yeah, that's awesome. And that's Alba, right? Like that's, Claire gets this moment, this insight here, I think. And we, the reader, get the insight over her shoulder of like, you love your children. You want to protect them as much as you can. And you have all these ideas of how to do that. But they're themselves. They belong to themselves. You only pretend they belong to you for a little while. And so I think that that's a really, I mean, it's a theme that runs through. I'm guessing it's going to run into the sequel or sibling book, but it's really kind of crystallized in that very small poem, which includes the crossouts, which I always love kind of when authors put on display the fact that, yeah, you always have to cross things out when you're writing. And hey, here's a little bit of crossout that someone could have done. But and one thing that's really great about this book is that within, I mean, this is something that we've talked about before, but within those really deep moments, and then you also have these super ordinary moments. I think that Henry and Gomez have this, they have this relationship that's sort of, no, it's sort of a cliche of male friendship, right? So when Charisse and Gomez have a baby at the exact same moment that Henry and Claire keep having miscarriages, I mean, unfortunately, that's a very normal situation that happens to people all the time. And Claire wants to hold the baby and Henry can't, right? And that's also a very ordinary human thing. And so there's this moment where they go over to visit and Gomez is smoking on the back porch with Henry. And Henry says he's too claustrophobic to be inside with the baby. And Gomez asks, "Hey, are you and Claire still trying?" And Henry says, "I'm startled by this until I realize that Claire probably tells Charisse everything. And Charisse probably tells Gomez nothing." And now that's like truth, right? Mm-hmm. that's a very legible description of modern relationships.
And the idea of not wanting to hold the baby is certainly tied to this loss of these children that Henry and Claire are a part of. But doesn't it also wink at the idea that he might disappear at any moment? And holding on to something as precious as a baby is difficult for him. And isn't that a reflection of the whole loss of the baby? It's so well put together.
I like that. I hadn't thought of that, Steve. But yeah, that's a great point. Absolutely.
3 stars for the Soto family.
And that relationship between Henry and Gomez then continues right up to the end, where at the end, where Henry knows this is the day that his life ends. The proverbial fat woman is singing is one of my favorite lines. And he invites all of his relationships into the house to be there for Claire in this moment. And my goodness, that's touching. She's frustrated with him, of course, and says, "Why did you let me have this party? Why did you let me have all these people here?" He said, "So that you wouldn't be alone," to finally give her at least this one moment of solace, to show her, these are the people who are with you. I'm leaving you. This is the end for me, but you will be okay. Oh, Audrey. If we could all have that moment. There's no question. I feel the loss in time travel, and Audrey puts together that loss in such a way that it makes me cry every time. And I hate this book. I don't want to read this book ever again.
Oh, you're going to read it 8 more times.
I know.
And I think
I had to go back over this chapter, these scenes again, because I was like, what am I missing? Because I was kept feeling I was missing something. So I'm glad you had all those emotions. Just recognize the stone didn't really move. It didn't move that way.
Oh, sorry, stone.
I know.
So
I had a question about the suicide of Ingrid. So Ingrid, for our listeners who have been reading along with us, was the girlfriend of Henry before we get to Claire. And eventually Henry comes back and he's footless and he watches his girlfriend commit suicide. And I just was like, all right, what was the purpose? Why was this important? Why was this scene so important? It was put in the book.
I think that goes back to that theme of longing. Ingrid lost Henry. Ingrid was in a relationship with Henry, and then one day he was in a relationship with Claire, and Ingrid was just out of the picture. Ingrid lost Henry and never really recovered from that. That longing, that loss, that suffering that she is a part of, she feels it so fully that she feels the only way out is to kill herself.
That is mental illness.
Yes. Yes, Ingrid is certainly an ill character. Ingrid is certainly suffering from her own mental state. And we see that when she's with Henry. They don't have a good relationship. They have a fighting, angry relationship from the beginning. We see that state of... there's so much going on with Ingrid.
I kept thinking I was missing something. That somehow, and later on we have scenes where Alba shows up, the daughter, and I was thinking that, well, maybe that has something to do with it. It was playing with her mind or something of that. I don't know. But I only read it once. So I was wondering if I missed something earlier in the book.
Well, and Chip, I wouldn't say that you missed something necessarily, but I also feel like part of what's being explored here is this very, very special relationship between Claire and Henry. And part of the reason that Claire and Henry work as a couple is that Claire is so open-minded. Because you guys, most of us aren't really in a position where we can easily say, oh yeah, I'd love to have a time traveler as my significant other for my whole life. I love the idea that I met my husband when I was 6 and he was 42. That's awesome. Like, Claire has this real I'm thinking in French, an ouverture d'esprit, like an openness of the spirit, an openness of mind that goes beyond like open-minded. But she has this ouverture that allows her to be the perfect partner for him. And Ingrid doesn't. Mm-hmm. That's very sad, but it's also, again, it's also very real, you know, that I think people date people where one person is way more into the relationship than the other. And it's just not the right relationship for one side. And it's funny because Gomez is in that position too, right? Gomez is in love with Claire for the entire time. Now he deals with it much, much better, but in a sense, he chooses his second favorite woman to be his partner for life. There's something very, very sad about the Gomez and Charisse marriage, especially that Charisse knows that Gomez would always rather be with Claire. Not such a touching scene when they have that conversation. So I think there is this notion of the sort of trade-offs that happen when you find this amazing love as you have between Claire and Henry, that then there are always other people who don't have that. And that's just real and totally devastating. It's a devastating novel in so many ways.
told you, I'm never going to read this book again.
Now, I paused when we got to Henry and Claire's first kiss from Henry's perspective. It's just such a deep and moving moment. It's quite near the end. When Henry is 36, Claire is 15. Claire has a terrible cold. And when Henry travels back, he is especially sad. He says, Claire has been torturing me for months, refusing to give up on having a baby, risking death and despair, turning lovemaking into a battlefield strewn with the corpses of children. Hmm. Again, devastating, but they keep having miscarriages. Henry is so upset. He goes back. He meets 15-year-old Claire. She has this awful cold and he kisses her. Not a nice kiss. He's very rough. She resists him, even though they've known each other for a long time. And then he pauses. And here's the quote. I place my hands over her ears and tip her head back and kiss her and try to put my heart into hers for safekeeping in case I lose it again. Hear Steve cry.
I hate this book.
But
it's just the next time he shows up, she's 18, right?
I don't know if that's the chronology of that, but soon thereafter is where she lays in wait on her 18th birthday for him and attacks him. Yes.
She's 15 here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that mm-hmm. was, and if I, and listen, my mind is, I'm forgetting, but I think there was just a long period of time maybe after this. I'm going from memory. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, the 2-year period is between age 18 and 20, Chip. So we're not.
Oh,
we're
okay.
Not
close okay.
To that.
Okay.
No,
okay.
No, because they're still going to go and tie Jason up to the tree and everything. So, yeah, I don't. But after that moment where he tries to give his broken heart to her, broken because they've had all of these miscarriages, mm-hmm. and she keeps wanting to try, then that kind of brings us, I think, to the end. So how sad do you guys think the ending is? Because Henry dies when he's 43. Claire is at that point 35. And basically, she spends over half her life just waiting for that one more time that she's going to see Henry.
Oh, that is just heartbreaking now, for me.
Is that true just love? Or is that like life lost?
It's a life lost. No, it's a life lost. She can't move on.
Yeah.
And the deal is he moved on because he's with his daughter. Mm-hmm. He's created the relationship with the daughter. And I listened to that again when I went on my walk this morning. Thinking that somehow I missed something, but I mean, I just constantly am like, okay, what did I miss here? Because you know, my heart's so small. But what I got is his life continues, mm-hmm. even though he's dead. He's spending his time with his daughter, and they're making the most of it. He's excited to hear what she's doing. She's excited to see him. All this is going on, but his relationship with his wife is over, except for the one time they see each other when she's older. But she is, I mean, at that point, she's wearing a black dress for the rest of her life.
Yeah. There's two more Doctor Who episodes that are linked here. There's The Girl Who Waited, which is all about this wait, this patience, waiting, and a life suspended. And okay, maybe you see it as a life ended at that point because she can't move forward. And then there's the story of Rory, who goes back to Roman times and lives life through from Roman times back to the present for the love of his wife. His wife is stuck in a time loop that she can't get out of. He goes the long way from Roman times back to the present. And that sacrifice of life, of time, in the name of dear, dear love, is heartbreaking here. I don't like that Henry told Claire about this moment. He tells her, don't wait for me. Go live your life. Forget about me. And then he tells her, but I see you when you're 80. So it's fine. And so she waits, and it's heart-wrenching.
And what he does there at the end, he leaves her a letter. And he does tell her verbally, don't wait. But in the letter, he says, Claire, I want to tell you again, I love you. Our love has been the thread through the labyrinth, the net under the high wire walked, the only real thing in this strange life of mine that I could ever trust. Tonight, I feel that my love for you has more density in this world than I do myself, as though it could linger on after me and surround you, keep you, hold you. I hate to think of you waiting. That's not the same as saying don't wait.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much the opposite of saying don't wait. It's saying, look, my love will keep you warm for the rest of your life. It will linger with you. It's a selfish, selfish way to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I think that you could certainly read this a little more, this book a little more devious than we have.
There are those moments where Henry, maybe unthinkingly, maybe he's not deliberately causing pain, but that idea of waiting, bothers me. It bothers me a lot.
As it should.
Yeah.
But
all right.
This is the darkness of having this kind of love. Right? There's a dark element to it.
There is that. There is that. You know, I think of all the relationships in this book, all of the different family relationships and friend relationships and all the things that Audrey was able to pack into this narrative. And yeah, one of the dark sides of that absolute, this is going to happen, is that waiting, that longing, that loss. It's devastating.
She's not, but not able to move forward. And there's the real, the tragedy of that is not moving forward. Now, I mean, she can grieve, she can take time, and I get that, but a lifetime of grieving is not fruitful. There is a challenge to that, and I would say that there's the fatal flaw of the story would be not moving forward, I mean, taking time to grieve is important. Taking the time to get started is also important. But at some point, the journey continues. And if you don't let your journey continue, you have a lifetime of longing for something that doesn't exist anymore.
Is that the fatal flaw or is that the theme? Is that what Audrey set us up for in the prologue? That idea of waiting, that idea of loss, looking across the ocean, waiting for the sailors to come back from their journey. Is that fatal flaw or is that real? I don't know. We've gotten to the depths of this book now. So, okay, fine. I don't know.
And Steve, again, I just want to thank you for bringing this one to the book club. This has been such a pleasure to read again and also to talk through with you guys, and especially with Audrey.
Yeah, I think Audrey was the best part of the show. I think we should disband the book club and just go talk to Audrey some more. No, we're not disbanding the book club. We're going to keep pushing forward, and we're going to have plenty of other conversations about plenty of other books and different perspectives from all sorts of different kinds of writing. So this one was my choice. So Chip, it's your turn. What are we reading next?
Well, what we're getting to do next is something no one has to prepare for. We're going to have a interview with a guy who we have interviewed many, many times, Mark Volger, about his brand new book that came out on Tomorrow's publication. It's Holly Jolly, Celebrating Christmas Past and Pop Culture. And for those of you who have followed us over the years, we've interviewed Mark Volger twice, one for his Monster Mash book that he put together with his wife. And this was a celebration of the pop culture of monsters and all those monsters that you love. And he also wrote one called Groovy, and it celebrated all the groovy things in pop culture. He is an incredibly gifted person and a fun interview, and we'll kick off the Christmas season or the holiday season with his book.
Awesome. Mark is a great guy to talk to. I look forward to talking to him again about his new book and all of his adventures since the last time we talked to him. So yes, the holiday season is upon us. We've got Thanksgiving and Turkey Day this week. For those of you who are celebrating Thanksgiving, be thankful for all that you have and that you're not a time traveler. And for the rest of us, we'll be celebrating Turkey Day. Pam, do you know what Turkey Day is?
I do not.
That's the day that we watch bad movies, also known as turkeys.
Nice. All right. That's a tradition I can get behind.
Yes. Yes. So that's coming up this week. And then we will talk to Mark Volger about the next holiday season with his book, Holly Jolly. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
We can come back so many times as time travelers. It'll be just fine. Just wait for next week. Oh, that's me saying to wait for next week. Oh, heartbreaking. What do you think, Pam?
Looking forward to it, because I have not actually met Mark Volger before, so that'll be fun.
It will be. We'll have a lot of fun next week. We would love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about The Time Traveler's Wife? Did you love it as much as I did? Did you put up with it and enjoy it as much as Chip did? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Send us an email. Our email is sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. And we'll get into the holiday season next week. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
Friendship has a blow in the past.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We'll see you in the future. We're Pam. I want to thank you again for listening to... No, I almost said it.